from the northwest, up to 15 miles per hour. Fog continues early tomorrow, then partly sunny, highs near 36.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle. Coming up on As It Happens.
Under threat, an Indigenous Greenlander tells us the U.S. president needs to be reminded that Greenland does not and will not ever belong to the United States.
And croak detector. A Utah police department recently started using AI to generate police reports from body cam footage, and they were shocked to read that while attending a call, one of their officers had turned into a frog.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There's more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The city of Grand Rapids has an open house on Wednesday, January 14th, 4 to 6 at Yanmar Arena. You can share your feedback on plans for American Legion Memorial Park. And the Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet on Sunday, January 11th, 9 to noon at their community center 12 miles north of Nashwalk on Highway 65. Enjoy a blizzard of flavors. Right now we're going to listen to a new song from Minnesota artist Paul Spring. From his album that came out late last year called Dumb and Free, this one's called Different Times.
I'm not like you, but I can pretend to live inside of your bars. Close up the walls around the globe. We're shrunken heads tall. Signs on the lawn, cut every week. Stickers on the truck, just washed. Keep one inside, in case a freak thinks he can crawl. These are different times. Lock up the door, even in broad daylight. They'll only want more. Different times. Different times.
Different times.
but I can pretend to live inside of your box.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
Annex Inline, an Indigenous Greenlander and former MP, says he welcomes more support from Canada as the U.S. president repeats and ramps up his annexation threats.
Piping up as Donald Trump vows to take back Venezuelan oil, an expert in Alberta weighs in on the impact that may have on the Canadian oil industry.
Plaque-listed, a Democratic congressman marks the anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol by digging up a memorial plaque that's supposed to be displayed prominently. But he's up against Republicans who have it hidden away in a basement.
A dress code? Formal. A Quebec teacher says new provincial civility rules that ask students to address teachers with more formal titles aren't about improving education, as the government says.
Cover story. The Grammy Awards are recognizing the best album cover for the first time in 50 years. One nominee tells us what that recognition means for his art and to the music it represents.
And jumping to conclusions. In an effort to cut down on paperwork, a Utah police department starts using AI software to generate police reports. And then, presumably, has to do more paperwork after one report says an officer transformed into a frog. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that keeps you on your toes. This is our hemisphere. So says the U.S. State Department, which posted those words on social media yesterday above an image of a glowering Donald Trump. Since taking action against Venezuela, Trump has mused about intervening in Colombia and Mexico and returned to a familiar theme, telling reporters the U.S., in his words, needs Greenland. The United States Homeland Security Advisor and White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller echoed his boss's rhetoric, speaking to CNN's Jake Tapper last night.
Greenland should be part of the United States. The president has been very clear about that. That is the formal position of the U.S. government.
Right, but can you say that military action against Greenland is off the table?
It wouldn't be military action against Greenland. The Greenland has a population of 30,000 people, Jake. The real question is, by what right does Denmark assert control over Greenland? What is the basis of their territorial claim? What is their basis of having Greenland as a colony of Denmark? The United States is the power of NATO. For the United States to secure the Arctic region, to protect and defend NATO and NATO interests, the United States should have Greenland as part of the United States.
In a statement tonight, the White House reiterated both Mr. Trump's desire for Greenland and the view that using the U.S. military to get it is, quote, always an option. Akaluk Linge is a former member of Greenland's parliament and one of the founders of the pro-Greenlandic independence party, Inuit Atakachigit. We reached him in Nuuk.
Akaluk Linge, you've been here before. The U.S. president has threatened Greenland's sovereignty before. But when you first heard those words from Stephen Miller, how did you react in that moment?
Well, it's kind of a déjà vu, you know, because it's 1 year ago tomorrow that Trump's son landed in Greenland and created this situation. Greenland is part of Europe. Greenland is part of Denmark. Greenland is part of the Nordic countries. We are part of the Western world, members of NATO. So why should U.S. do this to us? We are not an enemy. We have been friends with the United States for 80 years at least. What's going on here? I think we here have a very serious problem, and we need Canada's support.
They're suggesting that this is about security. in some way. What do you think is the motivation for this talk, this deja vu, as you said? Why do you think they're bringing this up again right now in this way?
About the security situation, we haven't done anything against them. Now that the Danes have already put forward billions of new money to protect the Greenland Arctic, now we have an alliance that are doing the opposite. It's very frustrating for us.
What
do you do with friends that are no longer friends? I don't know. And I think that all of us in the Arctic must be ready for anything. And I'm sure that Denmark and Canada are talking to each other very closely. We are in a very dangerous situation right now.
Prime Minister Mark Carney, Canada's Prime Minister, as you know, spoke with his Danish counterpart today. He's spoken about support for Denmark and for Greenland. And also we know that in February that our Governor General Mary Simon and Foreign Affairs Minister Anita Anand are going to be visiting. And she has confirmed that Canada will be opening a consulate in Nuuk. That visit, the comments so far, opening a consulate, how can that help in the face of what you're experiencing right now? Can it?
We need friends in Greenland, so we are very much welcoming the new office here. And it is important also that after Maduro, they are talking about Colombia, Panama, whoever, maybe Canada is the next, and then Greenland. It's really something that the Greenlanders are very nervous about. And I think that the vast majority of Greenlanders wants a steady connection to Denmark through the arrangements that we have. That's the only freedom we have. Mm-hmm. And the world must understand that Greenland is not about to do anything other than negotiating with Denmark, our closest ally for 300 years, and there's nothing that we intend to separate from Denmark.
You've campaigned for independence for Greenland in the past. Is this kind of pressure from the United States? Is it changing how you feel about that movement?
The question, what we need in Greenland is that we stick together to each other. We are not negotiating independence right now. The world has changed so much that it's not on the table anymore. Greenland needs Denmark, and Denmark needs Greenland, and we need Faroe Island together in the Danish Commonwealth. We need the support from the outside world. It's the United States that are separating from the Western world, and that's something that everyone should care about. My only hope is the good Republicans in the Congress in the United States and the Democrats. So I'm sure that the connections that we have with the United States should not be destroyed by this posturing that we see now. Really hope that the majority of the people of the United States are supporting the Greenlanders. We are part of your alliances.
What are people telling you just personally about how they're feeling?
Well, people are very nervous, and I get calls, and I'm saying that as long as we look at the international law, we should not have a problem, but it's outside the international law that things have begun to play out. And I think that the Western alliance, NATO, is in a big trouble as well. For Greenlanders, we are a small nation, a Christian nation, and we pray. And we pray that the Christians of the United States also will help us and not allow the military. That is how we look at the United States now. Regular people, they don't trust the United States anymore.
Akaluk Linge, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Akaluk Linge is a former member of Greenland's parliament. We reached him in Nuuk. Of course, this renewed interest in Greenland comes on the heels of the capture of Venezuela's president by U.S. troops. And now Donald Trump is making his plans for the country and its vast oil reserves known. The U.S. president is reportedly meeting with oil companies in the coming days and believes they can be up and running in Venezuela within 18 months. Today, Prime Minister Carney was asked if that concerns him, given that Venezuela pumps out a very similar oil to Canada.
It's been our view, and we're working towards this, that Canadian oil will be competitive because it is low risk, low cost, the marginal costs. There's been huge progress in getting down the costs, and low carbon, which is what the Pathways Project carbon capture will bring. And that makes Canadian oil competitive for the medium and long term.
Prime Minister Mark Carney speaking in Paris earlier today. Richard Matheson is the former CEO of the Crown Corporation Alberta Petroleum Marketing Commission. He is now an executive fellow at the University of Calgary. That's where we reached him.
Richard, do you share the Prime Minister's confidence and optimism?
I do. Actually, it was one of the things that I took away from yesterday and the day before. The U.S. wants oil. We are their largest supplier. We're very good at delivering to them, and we can continue to provide that oil. We compete against all the other producers in the world right now, and we do that effectively. We've been growing our market share. So I'm not at all concerned that we're going to be forced out of a market like it seemed on day one the reaction was going to be.
So you don't see a future ever where the U.S. does not need Canadian oil?
Well, they can try to get other oils, and I think that they will. They've been trying to replace declining Mexican Mayan heavy and Venezuela, which has been in decline for 20 years. They've been bringing in oil from Iran and Iraq and Colombia and other places. So there's always a competitive market for oil, especially once it's on a tanker. But Canada, over time, has been getting better and better at developing projects. The oil sands have something on the order of 20 operating projects. We put in place lots of infrastructure down to the U.S. And we understand our reservoirs very well. We know how we can expand them. Many approvals are in place for that. So if the U.S. needs more heavy oil, we can work with them to do it. We can get it to them by rail. Or if we need to, Keystone XL is always available to come back.
That's a subject for another interview and another time, certainly, and we will talk about it. But in terms of what the U.S. president is saying, we talked about the prime minister's comments, but you've heard Donald Trump's comments as well, claims that this is all going to get going year and a half, no problem. Is that a realistic goal?
I've heard nobody really confirm that. And what I saw yesterday was the big U.S. companies, Exxon, Chevron, and Conoco, really saying they're not sure what this whole situation is going to lead to. They aren't keen on getting back in there. Of course, they are private sector companies who answer to boards and investors, and they have to be able to show that on a risk-adjusted return over the long term, this would be a wise use of their management talent and their money. And right now, all that's changed is Maduro's out. Nothing is any better than it was before. And Venezuela has been listed for many years as one of the most difficult places to invest in the world because the economy was deteriorating and people are really in poverty and there's just not much going well there.
Yeah, we're talking about an entire country in the midst of incredible upheaval, an attack by the United States. In terms of ongoing trade negotiations, oil is a factor, leverage certainly. What do you think this situation as it is right now might mean for Canada at that negotiating table?
Well, I'm sure the U.S. will try to use it as a threat, but I think they've probably learned over the past number of months that they're very dependent on Canadian oil. So as we got better and grew our production from the oil sands to over 3.5 million barrels a day, we had to find markets. And most of that was in the Midwest, in Minnesota, around Chicago. All those big refineries put in the facilities to process our heavy oil. They take 60 to 70% of the feedstock comes from Alberta and is heavy oil oriented. all the pipelines from there run south now. They don't run north anymore because we have more oil than the Midwest needs, so they get down to the Gulf Coast. And so those refineries are the ones that are looking for heavy oil. They rely on us, and they're not going to want to shut off a source of supply that could keep companies competitive if they were producing from Venezuela. So, I mean, all refiners like multiple sources of supply. That's the way the world works. That's the way you get the best price. Canada is by far the most reliable supplier the U.S. has. And, I just believe that we're going to continue to be that way. And I expect that U.S. companies are going to tell the president that through the process.
The Prime Minister's optimism and confidence that we spoke about at the outset of our conversation, beyond that, what would you like to see, need to see from our government, the Canadian government, in the next days, weeks and months on this?
Yeah, I think the MOU was a huge step in trying to align provincial governments and the federal government. We need to continue down a path where we're working together as Canadians. Bring BC on board, bring Indigenous peoples on board. We need to look at a suite of opportunities to make sure that we have better market access. So those things include a pipeline, but they also include moving things like undiluted bitumen by rail. They can include partial upgrading, which is trying to make better use of pipelines by having less diluent in the system. There are emerging technologies to try and move bitumen in solid form without diluent. So there's a whole suite of things we can do as a country to work together to make sure that we have more market access, especially to Asia, which is a growing market. And I think right now we should all see that opportunity and seize it.
Richard, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Anytime.
Richard Masson is the former CEO of the Alberta Petroleum Marketing Commission. He was in Calgary. You're listening to a bit of Joe, that's spelled D-J-O. His real name's Joe Keery, and he's also an actor on the recently wrapped Netflix show Stranger Things. And that song just bumped Taylor Swift off the top of Spotify's global chart. But Joe is also part of another success story right now, one that celebrates the virtues of a more traditional side of pop music, and that's the album cover. While you might associate great album covers with the heyday of the LP or even the CD, the Grammy Awards disagree. This year, they're bringing back the Grammy for Best Album Cover, which was last handed out to a Frank Sinatra album 50 years ago. Jake Hirschlin's the artist behind the cover for Joe's latest album, The Crux, and he's nominated for this year's award. We reached him in Brooklyn, New York.
Jake, did you and the rest of the team, your collaborators, when you were crafting this cover, did you know that this category was coming back to the Grammys?
Not at all. I had no idea. I think it was very far outside of our vision that this kind of thing would happen when we were making it. But yeah, we're glad it did.
Glad it did, and glad you got the nomination. Yeah. How did that news come to you? How did you find out?
They break up the Grammy and the nomination announcements into different live streams, and I was watching one of the music ones, like Best New Artist or something like that. And I got a text from Joe's manager, Nick, telling me and Joe that the album cover had been nominated. And I was, it was like a different part of the live stream. It was like interactive live stream and coming at me.
He sends it to you. Yeah, interactive live stream. And what did you say? What did you do?
I don't even remember. I think I probably sent like a all caps what or something. Yeah.
To have this category come back, doing the work that you do, what does that mean for this kind of work, do you think?
I think it's really cool and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, not just because we're nominated, but I think it's a category that really should exist. The album covers are super important to most people I know that interact with music casually or professionally, I mean, it's an important part of how we talk about music and iconic albums. And I think it's one of the first things that comes to mind when you think of your favorite record. Or so I think it makes a lot of sense. It's like no small part of why records become iconic or important to people. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's meaningful and it gives motivation for people to care more about it.
Yeah,
I would
up
think.
Their game. And, it's not just, I mean, a beautiful picture of the artist is amazing, certainly, and can become iconic. But when you layer it with other meaning, it's something else.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, it's kind of whatever serves the music. Like, I think there's a universe in which, you know, it would have made a lot of sense to do a photo of the artist for our album. And this time we just had the conversations that led us in a different direction. And in a way, we kind of did a photo of the artist. It's just buried in a million other things. So
Well, I'm glad you brought it up because I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the other contenders as well, but yours up first. Describe for our listeners who haven't yet seen it, this cover.
Yeah, so it's a scene on a fictional street corner in a fictional version of New York of an older hotel called the Crux Hotel. The record is called The Crux, and the artist Joe is hanging out of the window of the hotel. And in the scene, you see in front of you this sort of theatrical, a medley of characters on the street corner going through their own moments, whether they're, you know, solemn or funny, or if they're in crisis. So it's just sort of like a maximalist scene of a lot of different characters that habit this world.
And Joe was involved obviously as well. What did he and what did all of you, as you listened to the music he made, want this cover to say? I mean, it says something that he wants people to have to try to find him.
The record being a story of a transitional period in his life and a big move across the country and a lot of changes in his inner world. When you make a move and you feel in transition, you often feel like you're just a small part of a big world. And I think that is what we were going for and hopefully comes across.
There will always obviously be vinyl with that image on it. Often it ends up on merchandise as well, but in this largely digital music world that there is now, what is the role of that art when it's, you know, a tile in an app for people often?
Yeah, I think that there's a way of looking at it where the cover has become less important. But actually, I think in the world we live in now, just because a lot of people aren't interacting with this large vinyl doesn't mean that they aren't interacting with the world that cover creates. So I think we, in a way, used this cover art as a springboard for a much larger digital universe. You know, it's like actually, it's for someone who's making stuff, it's actually kind of exciting to think that you have to take the original idea and then sort of explode it out onto all these other platforms and give viewers a lot more from one idea.
What about you when you were growing up listening to music? What were the album covers or CD covers or tape covers that really spoke to you?
I think, there's so many. I think Sgt. Pepper's was a big one growing up for me.
Yeah, just really a small little band. People may not have heard of that album.
Yeah, yeah. the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's cover was a huge, it was also a huge influence on this record. And like Deja Vu, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. I'm trying to think of like ones from my childhood. I grew up listening to this electronic group called Justice, and their album Cross has this amazing image that's sort of permeated the culture. And just that kind of stuck with me too, this idea of like creating one design, one singular image that sort of defines your whole career as an artist. I always thought that was cool.
The other contenders, the other nominees, I mean, some really powerful images from all of you. Perfume Genius, Tyler the Creator, Wet Leg, Bad Bunny. What did you think as you looked through what your colleagues in this space have created?
I mean, I really love that Perfume Genius cover.
It's disturbing almost, right?
Yeah, but it's disturbing, but it's super compelling. I remember, I mean, prior to any talk of Grammys, I remember really loving that cover. I even think I sent it to Joe, like just to remark on it. So I feel very humbled and happy to be in a considered in a category for something our team made. Just being among a group of artworks that you think are really great is an amazing feeling.
Well, Jake, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
Jake Hirschland is a creative director on Joe's album, The Crux, which has been nominated for a Grammy for Best Album Cover. The Grammys are bringing the category back after 50 years. The awards are handed out February 1st. Sorry, frog in my throat. It likely goes without saying that police reports are, important documents, which should be, accurate. But it also likely goes without saying that writing them up is a bit time-consuming and probably a bit boring. So perhaps it's no surprise that some police departments have leapt at the chance to let AI do some of the heavy lifting. Since December, the Heber City Police Department in Utah has been using AI programs that scan body camera footage and automatically generate reports. It's been a hit with the officers, but in terms of that accuracy part, occasionally, it's a real miss. One recent AI-generated report transcribed the moment in which an officer turned into a frog, or was turned into a frog. The mechanism of the transformation remained uncommented upon. Sergeant Rick Keel told local media that the report was mistaken. An investigation revealed the software had picked up on a Disney movie playing in the background, The Princess and the Frog, which I suppose means the report should have specified that the officer had turned into an animated frog. But now I'm just nitpicking. The most important thing is that the police department has learned its lesson. Sergeant Keel said, quote, "That's when we learned the importance of correcting these AI-generated reports," unquote. A somewhat belated revelation I'll leave uncommented upon. But to be fair, finding the right fit does often mean you've got to kiss a lot of frogs. And, I guess, sometimes turn into one. Excuse me. Here's Metric with Breathing Underwater. Metric with Breathing Underwater.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, 5 years since the January 6th attack of the U.S. Capitol, a congressman is fighting to make sure the bipartisan memorial plaque to honor that day doesn't stay stashed in a D.C. basement where Republican congressional leaders have left it.
And flake news. There's so much snow in Juneau that it's bringing down boats. A resident and harbor master of the Alaska town, who is 6'1", describes snow that's chest high. Stay tuned. I'm Lisa Bryn Rundle.
Thank you.
You're listening to As It Happens here on People Powered, KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. We'll continue more great music at 10 o'clock. It's Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. We also thank Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Patchy fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 14 to 18, winds from the northwest up to 15 miles per hour. Patchy fog early tomorrow, then partly sunny with highs near 36, west winds 10 to 15. For Thursday, partly sunny, highs near 34.
Depending on their political stripes, lawmakers in Washington are treating today as either a solemn day of remembrance or just another day at the office. Democrats marked the anniversary of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol by reconvening members of the House committee that investigated it to counter what they call the Republican Party's, quote, Orwellian project of forgetting, unquote. Meanwhile, House Republicans left the Capitol to attend a speech by President Trump at the newly rebranded Trump Kennedy Center. The two parties are also fighting over a memorial plaque, which was supposed to be installed outside the Capitol building, honoring the police who defended it. But so far, Republicans have kept the bronze plaque hidden away in the basement of a House office building. Joe Morelli is a New York Democratic congressman. We reached him in Washington.
Congressman, how did you mark this January 6th?
Well, today we held a hearing to hear from members who were here on January 6th, as I was, and who have roles to play as it relates to preserving the history of January 6th. But it's also been a day of just reflecting on that very, very dark day 5 years ago and the lessons that hopefully we've learned and we're going to continue to hopefully amplify for people who may not have. Well, I think everybody remembers it, but just to make sure that we're continuing to amplify the message of that day.
It sounds like you might be concerned about the context in which they remember it or how they remember it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think if this were the 16th or 17th century, you would understand why people committed such a violent attack on the Capitol might think that they had a chance to rewrite history. But this happened in the 21st century, and despite the efforts of Donald Trump and Speaker Mike Johnson and other Republicans in Congress, we're not going to let people forget. And I dare say people, for the most part, don't need to be reminded. They saw it happen in real time just 5 years ago. So it is fascinating that President Trump, though, continues to believe that he can get people to believe him rather than their own eyes.
This plaque that our listeners just heard just a little bit about, could you believe your eyes when you found it last May?
Well, I honestly, it's really hard to imagine that the Congress would by law commission the creation of this plaque honoring the dedicated service of the women and men who protected the Capitol that day, that that law would be so willfully ignored. And so I went looking for it, and we found it in the basement of one of the office buildings, and it's encased in, you know, a wooden box. And I had a chance to take it out and look at it. It's beautiful. It's appropriate to honor that sacrifice, and then recognizing that it wasn't going to be placed where it is supposed to be placed by law. So I had a replica made and put outside my office, and then more and more members of Congress were asking how they could get one. And the irony of the moment is, rather than placing the plaque where it's supposed to be, Speaker Johnson has now got 100 reminders of that day because there are at least 100 members who display a replica outside their office. So I'm pleased by that, but I'm also so profoundly disappointed and angry that that's necessary at all.
I've seen images of the plaque. Can you describe it for our listeners?
It's a beautiful plaque, and it has etched the Capitol complex of the United States Capitol. And underneath, simply, and this is the interesting part, it doesn't in any way, it's truly nonpartisan. It doesn't suggest any political views one way or another. It just thanks the sacrifice of the men and women of law enforcement, the National Guard, who came to defend the Capitol when it was under siege that day, and lists the various departments, the United States Capitol Police, the Washington Metropolitan Police Department, the National Guard, the National Park Service, et cetera, all of whom came eventually to the aid of members of Congress and their staff who were here under siege.
What have Republican congressional leaders said publicly or have told you about why this original plaque is sitting in a box in the basement?
Well, I think Speaker Johnson continues to raise what I would charitably call red herrings, reasons why he won't display it. At the end of the day, I think it owes entirely to his being in service of Donald Trump, who doesn't want to be reminded of the events of the day, nor does he want to be reminded that virtually every prominent Republican that day and in the days that followed heavily criticized him for inflaming the crowd and really directing them to go to the Capitol. And sadly, over the months that followed, Republicans started to fall in line and began to toe the line that the president has put out. But it doesn't change the day. As I said, this isn't centuries ago where you didn't have photographic and video evidence of what happened. Americans saw it, they remember it, and they continue to see it in images all around the world. So we're not going to let people forget, and historians won't let Americans forget what happened.
Have any of your Republican colleagues put up one of the replicas outside their offices?
I have not seen evidence of that. I think while many would probably privately tell you that they wish the plaque was prominently displayed, I don't know of any who had the courage to hang the plaque outside their office.
What is the image or the moment that stays with you most?
The image that I'll never forget is just the crowds of people with weapons all around the Capitol, swarming around the Capitol. And it truly is, in my mind, the darkest day in American history as it relates to this democracy and the fragility of the moment. I mean, we've had the peaceful transfer of power ever since John Adams gave the keys to the White House to Thomas Jefferson. And so that long tradition, now 220 years, was ended unceremoniously by Donald Trump. And so that's what that day means. And it also reminds us that we've got to be vigilant every single day to continue to maintain this democracy. It's not something you can, sort of walk away from your responsibility as a citizen. That's not allowed, and that's a stark reminder of what can happen should you not pay attention, or when people take it upon themselves to ignore the law and do just as they please. And that's what President Trump did.
Congressman, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you checking in with us. Continue. Good luck.
Thank you.
Joe Morelli is a New York Democratic congressman. He was in Washington, D.C. Boats in Juneau, Alaska, are sinking. It's not because of icebergs, though, or anything in the water. The threat is coming from above. Snow. Lots of it. The city saw about 200 centimeters in December alone. Matt Cresswell is Juneau's harbor master. He spoke to CBC's Max Layton.
I mean, I'm 6'1", and it's chest high on me. And it's just heavy snow loads on boats are causing boats to get weighted down and sunk. Yeah, the boats just sink, and they, you know, usually they stay tied up to the dock, and they're just hanging off the dock, sunk.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, and so what kind of boats are we talking about here? Are we talking about, you know, people's personal sailboats? Are they commercial boats? Like, what are they?
Anything from 16 to 58 feet long, from recreational to commercial to fishing. We've got 18 people moving snow, and they've been going nonstop for the last, I don't know, 10 days. We've got every snowblower we own running. We've got 5 front-end loaders going. We're just trying to keep up with it, and we're getting snowed on right now and just hoping it doesn't stack up too much on us.
Have you ever seen any snow like that in your life?
This is the most I've seen at one time. I mean, we get a lot of snow in Juneau, but it normally melts a little bit, then you get more, and it melts some, and you get more, but it's been below freezing for like 4 or 5 weeks, so we haven't had any snow loss to melt. It's just compaction.
You know, this morning we were talking about phase two. What do you anticipate phase two of this downpour looks like?
And that's just recovery. When everything's done and the snow's done and things start melting, then we've got to figure out what all the damage is, start making repairs to infrastructure, getting more boats raised up out of the water. And, you know, it's kind of the post-storm recovery part. Right now it's all about keeping more things from happening, more boats from sinking, and keeping things clear so people can access the harbors to get down and clean their boats off. And then as soon as it's all over and done with, then we'll move into phase two. We'll just start taking a look and seeing what's broke, what needs repairs, and go from there.
Matt Cresswell is the harbor master for Juneau, Alaska. It's back to school this week for students across the country, and for elementary and high school students in Quebec, it means some changes. The Quebec government has new rules in effect, requiring students to use formal language when addressing teachers and school staff. In English language schools, students are expected to use titles like Mr. or Ms., while students in French language schools are being asked to use vous instead of tu, considered the more polite form of you in French. The goal is to improve student behavior and increase respect in schools. Robert Green is a social sciences teacher at Westmount High School in Montreal. That's where we reached him.
Robert, how do your students address you? How do you like them to address you in class?
They address me as Mr. Green, and that's how it's always been. And yeah, I'm fine with that.
And so what is different in your classroom now?
Absolutely nothing is different in my classroom right now. Most of my students aren't even aware that this has happened. There has not been any sort of notices sent to the best that I'm aware of. It's just another usual day at Westmount High.
So what do you think the point of this is in this moment in time?
This whole new rule to me seems like the government striking a pose to appear to be doing something to improve education while actually doing nothing to improve education, and perhaps even making the situation for teachers and students worse.
How so?
Well, you know, one of the aspects of this rule is that students must address teachers with one of the two binary gendered pronouns. And here in Quebec, especially on the French side of the education system, there are educators that ask to be addressed with the pronoun mix. It's a gender neutral pronoun. And this rule prevents students from addressing them that way. And this really worries me because in some ways I feel like it is, on the one hand, denying students from a very marginalized community the right to have a role model in front of them. And, you know, even worse, I fear that this is given license to bullying that community because it is sort of ignoring something that is very important to them with respect to their identity. I don't think teachers feel that this is, you know, an important issue at all because, you know, again, even if the rule exists, how does the government intend on enforcing this rule? Like, ultimately, it falls on us as teachers to enforce the rule. And so, you know, if teachers choose not to do that, they won't. And if they choose to, they will, which is precisely how it was before this rule existed. I mean, you know, some teachers, particularly at the elementary level, do ask their students to address them by their first name. Or sometimes it even is like Mr. Robert, or, you know, Mr. First Name, or Miss First Name. Mm-hmm. And if teachers feel that that helps them establish a better rapport with their student and, you know, feel a sense of belonging in the class, then who is the government to tell them that they shouldn't do that? I think that this is just nothing but political posturing.
A spokesperson for the education minister told our CBC News colleagues in Montreal that it is up to, quote, school administrators to use their judgment when applying the regulations, unquote, and that they wouldn't be giving directives to schools in the cases of teachers who identify as non-binary and don't want to be called Mr. or Ms. Has your school laid out a plan to enforce these rules at all?
No, not that I'm aware of. No, it really does feel like a non-issue for most of us.
And in terms of what they said there in that statement about the pronouns, does that address any of your concerns?
Well, not really, because what if the school administrator decides that it must be, you know, one of the two binary pronouns? It opens the door. Mm-hmm. I think what amounts to a bit of an attack on the autonomy of teachers to manage their classroom in a way that they feel is best for their students.
There may be teachers, parents, even some students who'll say that, you know, a basic level of respect in schools and classrooms is missing often. So is there a value, do you think, in using more formal language to set the tone in a classroom?
If there was research out there on the question, you know, that addressing teachers as Mr. or Miss does result in more civility in the classroom, sure, I would be open to this. To the best of my knowledge, there isn't. However, there is a whole lot of research about what doing things like reducing class sizes does with respect to civility and issues like bullying in the classroom. Similarly, there's research about, you know, more support for special needs students gets real results in terms of like improving the sort of environment in the classroom and helping students with their learning. And so it disturbs me that there are sort of proven methods to improve civility that the government is ignoring. And instead, it's choosing to go with something that requires no investment from the government whatsoever, and that there's no evidence does anything to make any real improvements.
Is this the kind of thing you would discuss in your class as a social sciences teacher, this kind of debate? Oh, and what
absolutely.
Are they saying?
Absolutely. Actually, just at lunchtime today, I had some students in my classroom, and they're rolling their eyes. They're like, "Sir, this is ridiculous." And I did ask them, you know, are you in your French classes? Are your French teachers insisting that they're referred to with vous instead of tu? And most of them said that that's the norm in the class, but they also said that teachers are not like very rigid in applying that. And, you know, I really respect that. Like if a teacher feels it's important for them to do that, by all means, do that. And if stopping to enforce a rule like that would limit them from doing that, I could certainly understand why a teacher would choose not to pick that battle and to prioritize, you know, real learning and pedagogy over enforcing a rather arbitrary rule.
I'm really glad we could speak, Robert. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Robert Green is a teacher at Westmount High School. He was in Montreal. We reached out to the Quebec Ministry of Education. A spokesperson sent us a statement that reads in part, quote, "The purpose of this regulation is to establish a framework for civic responsibility that promotes respect for everyone in the school environment. It is expected to be applied judiciously and in this spirit," unquote. wasn't exactly what Jenny Blackmore and Callum Ewing were expecting right before the holiday season, mostly because they had no idea one of their goats was expecting. So the sudden arrival of baby goats came as quite a shock. And the situation was complicated because one of the new arrivals, who they named Holly, was hypothermic and had spent the first days of her life inside their Nova Scotia home. According to Ms. Blackmore, raising the little one has been a full-time job, especially since she isn't exactly toilet-trained.
I was in the drugstore, and the pharmacist walked by, and so I asked him, like, what's the smallest diaper? And he sort of said, well, what size baby is it? And I said, well, actually, it's not a baby, it's a goat. And he was very professional. He did a sort of a gasp, and then he said, oh, and continued to help me. So, yeah, so right now we're on newborns.
So tell me more about this surprise conception.
Oh, well, we don't know. Like, we didn't think it was happening, and we were looking at this goat thinking, my gosh, Missy's getting fat. And then she seemed to get fatter and fatter. And then we were really wondering, but we were thinking it was impossible because we don't have a billy goat. And the last billy goat that left here was just a tiny one. It was one of our previous birthings. But he's the only one that we can blame.
But there's no other possible explanation.
No, never. We sort of made a pact. No more billy goats.
Oh, tell me more. What led to that pact?
Well, we're just not going to have any more billy goats on the property because this is the kind of thing that happens.
She looks to me to be about 16 inches maybe from nose to tail or a little more than that.
I would think more like 20.
Okay.
When you find a hypothermic baby, they're very sad looking because all the organs have started to slow down and they're unconscious and they're just, the head flops, the jaw is open, the mouth is hanging out. She's grown phenomenally. It's not like a puppy. I was thinking, why is this so much harder than a puppy? And I think what it is, they grow so much quicker than a dog. And so they still have all the same care required, except they also have all the naughtiness, which is, you know, coming on like a freight train.
Tell us more about the naughtiness.
Every day is something different because one day she learns to jump on the couch. And so there's a day of like falling off the couch and not quite making it. Now we're pruning the houseplants and we're also interested in wires.
Can she chew through them?
Not yet, but she's working on it. That'll probably come tomorrow.
Is she cuddly? She looks cuddly
now.
She's all
cuddly.
Curled up on the couch.
She's very cuddly. And so, like, after she's fed, she loves to just have a cuddle on your knee and this kind of thing.
Jenny Blackmore speaking to CBC Nova Scotia's Alex Mason.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard right across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Brin-Rundle. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nia Cooksall. Take care.